talking to Henry Jacobs on, what's today, 14th?
Or no, 15th? I think it's 16th. Probably 16th.
16th.
Yeah. October.
Okay, 15th of October, 1994, in case somebody's transcribing this 10 years from now.
1 week after my 70th.
Oh, my God. And we are, geographically, how would you identify this?
We're in, on the coastal California, north of San Francisco, on a small piece of land called the Point Reyes Peninsula. And we're roughly about 4 miles from the Atlantic, the Pacific Ocean, on a ridge about 900 feet above sea level.
All right. Well,
and we're about 20, what is it, about 20, 25 miles from San Francisco, maybe?
I never counted the miles.
Yeah.
I lose count on the way.
All right. Well, there are two lines that I wanted to pursue. One of them being your association with KPFA and the broadcasting there, and the other, not totally independently of that, your very early involvement with experiments in musique concrète.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to start off with the KPFA part mm-hmm. first and ask you simply, how did you become aware of KPFA and how did you become involved with it?
Okay. I had going back to the middle 40s, it started out with a strong interest in jazz music, American jazz music. Then my early college years, I got sort of opened up to classical music and went through the symphonies and the chamber music of Beethoven. And somewhere, probably in the late 40s, somebody in Chicago introduced me to Indian classical music. And I became good friends with a man named Dick Waterman, who taught at Northwestern University in ethnomusicology with Herskovitz, Melville Herskovitz.
Mm-hmm.
And I became very excited about so-called ethnic music. And in the late 40s, I left the United States, went down to Mexico, and worked in commercial television for a few years, and returned to the U.S. in 1953, and through an old friend, I happened to get a job at the University of Illinois, where they were setting up an educational television station, and there was also an educational radio station at the University of Illinois, and there were lots of foreign students at the university, and I got the idea of doing a weekly program called Music and Folklore, which related to ethnic music and interviewing people from different countries and talking to them about the music of their country. And I must have done about 25 or 30 programs, and I knew Al Partridge slightly, because his brother-in-law was a good friend of mine, and I knew about KPFA and Al's experience there. So I sent some tapes to KPFA, and they started broadcasting them back. This must have been about 1952 or something.
Mm-hmm. Right, that figures.
And I didn't, after living in Mexico, and I'd lived in Havana for a short while, and I didn't like being in Champaign, Illinois. It was pretty provincial there and not really to my taste as a place to be, bad weather, et cetera, et cetera.
I've spent some time there. And I
in Champaign, Urbana?
Yeah.
Yeah. So a friend of mine lined me up with a job in San Francisco working for the United Bay Area Crusade, which is like the community chest.
Mm-hmm.
And I came in to work as sort of a radio, TV, film coordinator for them. And immediately when I arrived in the Bay Area, I touched base with KPFA and met some people like Alan Watts, whom I later became a close friend of. And my programs were part of the KPFA regular schedule at that time, my music and folklore programs. And probably around 1955 or 6, somewhere in the mid-50s, it became apparent that if I wanted to go and become a staff member at KPFA, I could. I got along very well with Lou Hill. And another friend of mine, Gerd Stern, had just...
Yes.
Gerd had just left being the promotion director, and so I came in and took that job. Mm-hmm. And by that time, I was getting fairly used to being a straight interviewer of various ethnic people. And then I started to have fun with it and do sort of satirical things. I did one interview with a mythical Hebraic scholar named Sholem Stein. We mm-hmm. did an interview about...
Interviews of our time.
Yeah, oh. Right. And I did an interview where I was a jazz musician, sort of a bebop jazz musician, Shorty Petterstein.
Who were the other people involved?
Woody Leifer and myself. Woody Leifer is an old mm-hmm. WQXR guy mm-hmm. from New York.
You were the only two voices.
Two voices on the original mm-hmm. Folkways, which mm-hmm. later became a fantasy recording and later mm-hmm. got attributed to Lenny Bruce.
Yep. That came out. Were you involved with the only one on that I thought that Lenny Bruce had anything to do with, the March of High Fidelity?
No.
Where he was the voice on that. But that was the only thing on that record that I could identify is his having had anything to do with it at all. Because of course it came out originally that 10-inch LP, or at least the one that I knew, with that marvelous. Who were the people in the photograph?
Oh, that was, there were a couple of gay women from Sausalito. One of them was a poetess, whose name I can't recall. She was sort of a well-known figure in Sausalito, and her lover.
Mm-hmm.
And they were reading a book called Pigs Ate My Roses.
Yeah. But wasn't there a man on that there as well?
Saul... Max Weiss, one of the younger Weiss brothers who originally owned Fantasy.
Ah. Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, Mo Ash of Folkways wanted to put out an LP of some of my sound experiments, which I was doing with tape
mm-hmm.
loops,
mm-hmm.
and some of these interviews and whatnot. And we did an LP called Radio Program Number 1, which Ralph Gleason heard and thought the jazz interview was hilarious, and he mm-hmm. talked the Weiss brothers into getting the rights to those interviews from Folkways and putting out a 45 called Two Interviews of Our
mm-hmm.
Time.
Yep, that's the original form I remember now.
And then they were so thrilled with that, they wanted more material, so Woody and I were working on more material, and I had a stack of 7-inch tapes that I had accumulated of various interviews and monologues and whatnot. And the Weiss brothers and Saul Zantz of Fantasy said, you know, we'll bring things in, we'll listen, and we'll pick out the good material, and we're going to put on an LP called More Interviews of Our Time. So I took, must have been 40 or 50 7-inch reels of tape. Each reel would have maybe 5 minutes here, 2 minutes there. Mm-hmm. And at one point, it just happened to coincide that Saul Zantz's birthday was coming up. And so Woody Leifer and I did this sort of put-on birthday thing for Saul Zantz, which... among other things, questioned his virility and his masculinity, and he didn't think it was funny.
he was really pissed. And a few weeks later, somebody from Fantasy called me and said, guess what? Somebody broke into the skylight and took all your tapes. And I said, what do you mean my took? Yeah, they broke in. They only took your tapes. And I think it was Zance told me. And he said, isn't that funny, asshole, you know? And then the next thing I knew, a few months later, they came out with an LP called More Interviews of Our Times, where they crossed all the names out. Lenny Bruce's name wasn't there, my name, but it was a lot of Bruce's material,
plus these two, the Sholem Stein interview. And I never got any money from Fantasy for years and years and years. And then comes the 70s or whenever it was, and they hit it big with Creedence Clearwater. And I think there was so much money floating around Fantasy that finally I started to get royalties. Never.
It's called the trickle-down theory. Yeah,
it's the trickle-down. We were talking about KPFA, so...
And it went sideways into one of the things I was going to ask you about, which was the interviews of our time, and you covered it without my asking you.
Yeah. Then, in the early 50s, somebody called me, I don't recall who, but they said, John Cage is coming to town, he's going to do a concert, he heard that you're into tape recorders and da-da-da-da-da, and would you assist on getting this thing together for this performance of Sonata for 12 loudspeakers or whatever.
Yes, the Imaginary Landscapes.
For
12
things.
Radios.
All right. So I talked to somebody I knew from Ampex and got a bunch of small Ampex playback speakers and tape recorders, the little 600 series.
Oh, yeah. It was my first tape recorder.
Those brown cases.
Yep.
And John came, and I said, well, now what do you want to do? And, well, he wanted to have these 12 tapes that would start. And this one would be this radio station. This one would be another radio station. And I was thinking, well, you know, now I'll put markers on so we can start them. No, it doesn't make any difference. Just any old way is fine, you know. Well, John, I mean, isn't this a common? No, just do it any old way, you know. So we did a concert of, which was Sound in Space, basically. And I thought that was pretty interesting. And I'd been spending a lot of long evenings playing with tape loops, which are kind of like what they do now with sampling. Mm-hmm. And I was fascinated that you could, you know, go, you could take a loop and go, mm-hmm. And then you'd get this continuous rhythm. By that time, I was really hooked on the whole African, Cuban, polyrhythm world. And I thought that, you know, maybe I could enter that world in this kind of technical way, and I would run into the city and hang out with Mongo Santa Maria, the famous Cuban conga drummer. He'd come and he'd hear my loops, and he'd make loops for me. And then the wife of a friend of mine, a filmmaker named Jordan Belson, and abstract filmmaker, his wife Jane Belson, happened to go to the Morrison Planetarium in San Francisco, and she came back and she said, gee, do you know they have in the planetarium, they've got these speakers all around the theater and da 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 da, and we ought to, you know, we could really do something there. So I was
what date are we looking at now?
We're looking at early 57, late 56. Mm-hmm. And so I approached the people at the planetarium and said, I'm Henry Jacobs. I work for KPFA. Would you be open to the idea of co-sponsoring an experimental music event? There's this new music that's developing where people are doing these things with magnetic tape that they could never do before.
And this is before Varese Poem Electronique for the Phillips Pavilion,
yeah.
Which was 58 or 59.
Yeah, right.
Right, okay.
Right. So they were open to it. So we gathered a dozen examples of musique concrète, which was basically tape splicing, mm-hmm. of electronic music, which was getting into the Stockhausen bloop, mm-hmm. bloop bleep is what mm-hmm. yeah. I've learned to call mm-hmm. that. And then there was, by that time, there was a sort of rhythm, what do you call it, rock, kind of early rock and roll Sputnik influenced mm-hmm. stuff. That would go beep, 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 and put it with mm-hmm. popular music. So we took examples of all those things.
Did you use any material from the Paris school? Pierre Henry and Pierre Schaeffer?
Yeah, Yep, we used, and from Takamitsu and the people in mm-hmm. Japan, and Ligeti, and then there were a few kind of nerd-type guys hanging around Ampex, a guy named Gordon Longfellow. Who'd done some things. There was David Talcott, who did some really interesting things. Mm-hmm. And he went down the tubes pretty bad, didn't he, Eric?
Were you aware of Tristram Cary in London, who was working along these lines? Tristram Cary. He was the son of Joyce Cary, the novelist.
No, I wasn't.
Yeah. Well, he was, in fact, even back, like Schaeffer and Henri, he was doing this back in the... In the disc days of taking things off of disc and transferring to other disc and creating loops by breaking across the path of the groove path
like a broken record.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which was what the very first things that Pierre Schaeffer did. Mm-hmm. The Chemin de Fer.
Yeah.
The very first example ever mm-hmm. from about 1949 or thereabouts, mm-hmm. which he did by means of disc,
right.
and the way that he got this, I know that I'm interviewing you the other way around, but I'm just going to throw in that the way that he got into this was that he was the sound effects man for drama, on Paris Radio,
uh-huh.
and he was a great virtuoso with disc players,
uh-huh.
Introducing sound effects live uh-huh. into the context of radio drama,
right.
And so he had developed his manual techniques out of that experience with radio drama, and so when he conceived the idea of playing around with these sound effects and making abstract sonic images out of it, he had the techniques. He was like a sculptor
mm-hmm.
already, and he could just do it. The most mm-hmm. amazing accomplishments with the most primitive equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the end of that.
a name I should probably mention was one of my good friends from the Middle West who was really into the technical end of sound, and he was one of the early figures in quadraphonic sound, a man named Jim Cunningham.
Mm.
And he had, at one point, had given me his first experimental stereo recorder, which was staggered heads. It was, he'd taken an old tape recorder, a mono tape recorder, and mounted an extra preamp and mm-hmm. staggered heads.
Yes. Yeah.
And you could record stereo. And I took that machine, actually, on a trip down to Haiti and recorded in Haiti.
Yes, I remember that, and getting any kind of phase coherence out of that was the very devil.
Yeah, right.
Now, do you remember how many loudspeakers they had in the planetarium?
Well, they had basically 12 stations, and I think each station had 3 speakers. And then we asked them to build us a switching device, which was like a motorman's rotary thing.
Oh.
And so you could go like this, and the sound would go around the room like that.
Uh-huh. And it made its connections on a series of points.
Yeah.
Like the old stud rotary pots on early mixers.
Right, exactly. So we, and then an important part of this was that Belson was into doing all these 16-millimeter film experiments and animation and whatnot, mostly in a sort of cosmic, sort of Duchamp-type direction. With he was really fascinated with all of the hypnotic designs that Duchamp had developed. They're kind of like mandalas, all that, spirals, and all of that was very much a part of the vortex experience. So we worked with modulating sound, moving sound in an environment, with the full range of visual experience from total blackness through one point of light in total blackness to maybe the entire dome of the planetarium filled with spots of light wobbling and giving you vertigo.
You must have been some of the very first people into the son et lumière concept that's so taken over at cathedrals.
In Europe, yeah. Well, we made the connect with Europe in 58, I guess it was. We got somehow through somebody, through Stockhausen or somebody, we got invited to the Brussels Fair, the World's Fair, and we went over and performed Vortex.
In 58?
Yeah.
That must have been contemporaneous with the with the Phillips Pavilion.
With the Phillips Pavilion, yes, it was.
My God!
And we had this.
Were you ever in any communication with the people that developed the technology for the Phillips distribution?
Yeah, we met. I'm trying to remember somebody, Vermeulen, I think his name was, from Holland. We talked at length with him and wrote letters back and forth.
Yeah. So there was communication in
advance.
And
Hank, we had used music of Hank Baddings.
Hank Baddings,
Yeah.
Right.
And it turned out that the planetarium in Brussels happened to be on the fairgrounds of the World's Fair, and it was just this funky little old planetarium, a small one. But we had made arrangements to perform Vortex there. And they even gave us a little apartment in the planetarium that we lived in while we did, I think, half a dozen performances. And then we came back, and the planetarium in San Francisco, the management had become nervous about Vortex because it was so popular. And it made their thing look bad because, you know, we would on a Monday night end up with 2,000 people coming to the planetarium. We'd have to perform our thing three times. And
the old familiar story.
And I was getting two messages about that time. One was that you definitely don't want to end up making your living at the Hungry Eye telling jokes or being some spaced-out jazz musician or some wild musicologist talking to a bunch of drunken idiots who are smoking cigarettes. And I, by that time, I had become married to a very special person from Japan, and I was sort of living in Japan. I was in California, but our home was Japanese, and because my wife didn't speak English very much, all of my verbal skills didn't fit into that particularly well. So I was sort of getting into another kind of looking forward to full moons and plants and nature and hiking. And I knew I didn't want to be in the...
From hiking to haiku.
Yeah. And I'd had a pretty good taste of the whatever it was, Success or whatever, you know, Time magazine, Look magazine, Life magazine, guest shot on Groucho's program.
You know. You had a guest shot on Groucho's program?
Yeah.
I can get mine if you run out of it.
I'm going to remove this just for a minute because I have to bring a document.
It's blown my mind. I don't know if it's going to blow your mind.
Let's turn it on again, and we'll take off from where we were.
This is an example of how absurd it got. First of all, let me make it clear. I'm not and never have been a jazz musician. Mm-hmm. I did try learning to play the sitar from Ali Akbar Khan and failed. Mm-hmm. I spent 5 years on that. This is a book by a man named Gene Lees. It's called Meet Me at Jim and Andy's, which is apparently a jazz hangout in New York City. The subtitle is Jazz Musicians and Their World. And there are 13 chapters. I'm just going to tell you a few of the chapter titles. Chapter 13 is The Bachelor, Paul Desmond. He played with Brubeck, right?
Brubeck, yeah.
The Teachers, Chapter 10, Billy Taylor, piano player who's got a video series. The Poet, Bill Evans.
Oh, yeah.
The Father, Woody Herman. Chapter 5 is The Romantic, Artie Shaw. Chapter 4 is The Enigma, Duke Ellington. Now, of its significance here is that as a child, say 10, 11, 12 years old, I became totally and absolutely enamored of Ellington and his whole trip, the band, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Chapter 2 of this book is called The Mask, Shorty Petterstein.
Shit.
I'm not kidding. I mean, if that isn't absurd... And this guy, Gene Lees, he was a Downbeat editor. He writes this article about Shorty Petterstein and the significance of the hip style or the hip. Nowhere in there does he mention me or Woody Leifer or, you know, no credit whatsoever. But to be in a book with Artie Shaw and Duke Ellington as a chapter heading.
And he mentions Lenny Bruce and Mort Saul in connection with the Shorty Petterstein, which at least was at least more or less contemporaneous. Yeah.
Well, anyway.
Amazing. Well, you've well, what more could one ask for than to have passed anonymously into legend?
that's about what's happened, yeah. So anyway, now we were at KPFA, and this Vortex thing started to happen, and it started to, you know, we got this invitation to go to Europe, and we were communicating with people all over the world, and then after the Brussels experience, we found that the planetarium was afraid of Vortex because it was too popular and too many people were smoking funny-smelling cigarettes outside in the line
it
waiting.
It was the arc lamps.
So they said, well, we've helped you set this thing up and you've gone to Brussels and you're big time now. So that's it. We're going to do it one more time. So we did our fifth. We actually did five different Vortex programs. The fifth one probably took place in early 59, something like that. Then we needed to find a new venue for it. And we talked to the people at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, and they had a big room, big square room with a screen at the end, and they said we could use that room. And we said, yeah, we need a dome. We want that organic, you know. So we tried to do we did a show with a conventional screen and with people sitting like this looking at a screen. We did a program that called Vortex Presents. And by this time, my associate Belson was getting sort of prima donna'd out. And he had produced a film that I did a soundtrack for called Allures, which he had gotten a number of grants for. And I didn't like what had happened because he would make these films with soundtracks, and then he'd just at the end say a film by Jordan Belson.
Ah.
So we went our separate ways. I was in this marriage, this Japanese woman having children and whatnot. And I had just about the time of Vortex had produced this record of haiku poetry, because an ex-girlfriend had introduced me to haiku, and then my Japanese wife had filled me in on whatever the American girlfriend hadn't. Mm-hmm. And I decided to do a record, and I had this close friend, a percussionist named Vincent Delgado, mm-hmm. he's very tight with Alaraca's son, mm-hmm. the tabla player, mm-hmm. Alaraca's son. I can't think mm-hmm. of his name, but he's now the world's greatest tabla player. And Vince loved to kind of play telegraphic music on the shamisen and koto and Japanese percussion instruments and whatnot. And I thought, we'll do these Japanese poems, these haiku poems in Japanese with this sort of haiku telegraph-like music echoing the poem, and then we'll have a voice read it in English. And I didn't feel confident enough about my voice, and I didn't know Eric at that time. I probably mm-hmm. would have gotten him had I known him.
Well, yes. Yeah.
But the next best choice was Watts. So I got Watts to read the poems in English. And we made a record. I, by that time, had a record label called MEA, mm-hmm. which started out standing for Musical Engineering Associates, because some other friends of mine had built some percussion instruments and whatnot under this name. And this record of haiku poems got a rave review in the Sunday New York Times, and lo and behold, I'm getting all this feedback of, where's haiku, can we get haiku, blah, blah, blah. And this British fellow named Peter something, can't think of his last name now, was working for Botsford, Constantine, and Gardner, an ad agency. He called me up. He said, I heard your haiku record. He said, we have a client, Japan Airlines, and they're just introducing their jet airplanes. And do you think you could come up with a sound logo for involving jet aircraft and something Japanese? So I dreamed up this thing of combining a jet sound of with a Japanese flute that went mm-hmm.
and put shakuhachi sort of thing.
Yeah, and I mixed the two, came up with this great logo, and they loved it. And suddenly, I was in the commercial world of, and I had this job for about 7 years, where I would. The agency would call me up and say, okay, the scripts are ready. I would call this Nisei girl actress named Lonnie Miyazaki, a theatrical person, and she would come up to Sausalito. I had a sound studio there, and we would spend about 5-6 hours recording voice tracks of these fly to Japan at almost the speed of sound. And your stewardess will bring you oshibori hot towels, you know, all that kind of mm-hmm. stuff.
Did you do your own technical operation of the sound equipment for this, or did you work with an engineer?
No, I did it all myself. By that time, I'd acquired a whole bunch of maybe 4 or 5 Ampex 351s, and mm-hmm. I had a 300, the first 3-track machine, 300-3.
Okay. Yes.
And they had just invented cell sync, so you could actually, mm-hmm. you know, do sound and sound and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I had a job there for about 7 years where in 2 days I could make about $12,000. Back in the 60s, you know.
Yeah.
So then the rest of the time, these guys like John Handy and Ornette Coleman and Sonny Rollins, and they passed through town, and here there was this hip studio in Sausalito with this great big concrete horn. and
sort of clip exponential sort of thing.
It was at the mouth, it was about 9 feet, and at the other end, it was 12 inches. Mm-hmm. And it was, you could climb up into it. It was about 10 feet deep. You could, you know.
Oh, God. Do you remember what was driving it? What kind of a driver you had behind it? Was it Altec?
It was an expensive speaker. I don't remember offhand, but there were, it went through different speakers. People would keep coming up, you got to try this Altec or something.
Yeah.
But so I was free for many years there to just, usually it would be a black musician, and usually they wouldn't have any money, and so they'd come in and we'd hang out all night and record them.
You could spend 2 days making $12,000 and then spend a couple of weeks spending it.
Right. It was sort of like that. And then the effects of devoting an entire evening to being in a planetarium wearing a white surgeon's coat.
You're hitting a microphone.
Oops. Wearing a white surgeon's coat and being this kind of futuristic mad scientist thing and playing this music at loud volumes. And by around 1960, I decided musique concrète and electronic music are not happening. What is really happening is the real actual instruments. There's this other thing that's starting, this kind of rock and roll thing and electric guitars and audiences of 100,000. And it's an interesting social phenomenon, but it's so much content all the time that there's no space in it, and there's no rhythm really, because it's just wall of sound. And some people were better and more interesting than others. People like Steve Miller, I think, showed some interesting talent. And I'd had some experience of recording some of the early groups like Quicksilver Messenger Service, and they'd show up at 7 o'clock to record the Star Spangled Banner. There'd be about three gorgeous young ladies without panties and maybe a popcorn bowl full of herb, and they'd come in and they would play the same tune over and over and over again till 5 in the morning, you know, trying to get what they wanted. And I thought, hey, I don't know if I'm game for this shit, you know. Because those electric guitars, they can get pretty loud, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you can do yourself permanent damage.
Right.
Which they do.
And about that time, I'd established, without having any credentials of electronic sophistication, I mean, as far as being an engineer is concerned, or really being a musician, I hadn't studied with Ali Akbar Khan by that time. That happened in about 65. And I started getting calls from people saying, well, you know, we're doing, it started out, somebody from, one of my friends was at Presbyterian Medical Center, and they were anticipating getting into computers for medicine. And this friend knew that I had a Nagra.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, would you come over and record this conference on medical information systems? And I said, sure. And he said, you know, they'll pay you $30 an hour or whatever it was. So I show up with my Nagra. And everybody there, all these doctors and computer people, assume that I'm, because of the Nagra or something, assume that I'm one of the authority figures of the thing, or what they were talking about. The next thing I know, a guy named Frank Gerbode, who was a famous surgeon, heart surgeon, open heart surgery, he calls me up. Henry, I wonder if you could help me. We want to put a video system into open heart surgery, da 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 da. Can you help design it? So, I started calling camera manufacturers and stuff, and getting it all together to put in the system. And the one thing I knew was that the system, that the, to make the system really useful to them, was to have it, the whole system, all the cameras, monitors, there was a monitor in the doctor's office across the street, the whole system got controlled by one toggle switch.
Mm-hmm.
That was my contribution. I want it all to end up at this toggle switch, says, and it has a label on it, says TV system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that turned out to be, I didn't know it at the time, but it was the brilliant move, because actually it turned into a thing that, you know, some kid that scrubs the surgery or something, you know, he could come in and turn it on an hour before so everything's warmed up.
This is the secret of authority throughout the ages.
I guess. So, and then it just mushroomed from there. The next thing, I got a call from the Bank of America. They're building the world headquarters. Would I design the audio-visual systems for the world headquarters? And I'm competing against these guys who'd work for NASA and somebody mm-hmm. in Texas that had worked for NASA. You know, and I don't... it was bizarre.
Wonderful.
And I'd go... What was great was I'd go to these meetings with the architects and these Bank America people, and we'd get on a plane and fly down to Southern California to look at some college where they had all this multimedia screen stuff and everything. And we'd end up in a bar someplace, putting in an hour waiting for the plane to come. And I'd get with these bank people, and it'd end up we'd be talking about music, and the bank guy says, I've got a complete collection of all the 8 tracks of Herb Alpert. Do you know who Herb Alpert is?
Tijuana Brass.
The most trivial, trashy, mm-hmm. uninteresting crap in the world. And
got himself
sitting
very
there,
rich with his own label. Well,
I'm sitting there earning $25 an hour back in the 60s, mm-hmm. listening to somebody talk about his 8-track collection of Herb Alpert. So at that mm-hmm. point, I figured, well, hey, if they're that lightweight, mm-hmm. I'm okay. I can handle this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, well, with experience, you could have moved up to Montevani.
Right, right. Or Wayne Newton, maybe. So,
oh boy. Now, I just want to ask you one thing. Have we totally left KPFA at this
well,
point?
What can I say about KPFA? I edited the folio while I was there, and I used to take great pleasure in telling lies like the lie about the forest
the
over there
uh-huh.
in the folio.
Useful lies.
Useful
yeah.
lies.
Could I ask you dates on when you edited the folio, or at least approximate dates?
Well, I would say I was editing it probably from maybe 55 to 57, 56, 57, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right up to somewhere around the time that Lou Hill
committed
suicide.
Yeah, and then about that time, this Vortex thing was getting huge, and we were getting grants from people mm-hmm. to go to Europe, and so I decided to go freelance at that point. I left mm-hmm. the KPFA staff. Continued doing the music and folklore program. Then somebody decided to hire me to do the guy who got Channel 20, Jim mm-hmm. Gabbert. They had a station. He and his lover had a station in Palo Alto called KPEN.
Mm-hmm.
And they hired me to do a program called Offbeat, which was basically weird humor and ethnic music mm-hmm. combined. And by that time I was beginning to notice an interesting phenomenon, and that is, if you got all these records that you really like a lot, and you want to expose them to the world and get people to listen to them and be interested in them, but if you're doing that and you're on the radio, you're making a tape or something, that while the record is actually playing, you're not enjoying it, you are thinking, okay, when the record ends, I'll say, that was the great African
mbira player, Mangunga Jumbo, from his recording on, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I was beginning to notice that if you start making money at the thing you really like, it gets to be kind of a turnoff. It's not so much fun. Mm-hmm. So, and then this, by that time, this, you know, from being this great sound engineer to being this electronic wizard, which people thought I was, and people would come up to me, you know, and, oh, yeah, I've heard about you. Yeah, and you really, boy, how do you do that? How do you figure all that electronic stuff out? Mm-hmm. You know, and here I am not really knowing the difference between an ohm and a watt, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew how to push start and play and the cell sync and all that stuff. I was good at that, and I got real good at tape editing. Mm-hmm. I read Joel Tall's book. You know that book?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. The Bible, right?
Editor of the editor, or inventor of the Edital.
Yeah, right. And then I got into the rhythm of speech and how you can, you know, if you have a change in background sound, you throw a cough in and you cover the airplane or whatever, all that stuff that Joel wrote about. And I used to
love... Which nobody bothers to do anymore. Right. Because production values have gone straight down the plug hole.
Right, right. And then I kind of got into this working theory that if you got into having fun with somebody, you know, and I said, well, John, how long did you work in this delicatessen? And you just pick it up from there and say, oh, yeah, I remember cutting the, you know, and I say, well, you know, and you were mayor of Cleveland at the same time working in the delicatessen, you know, and we go off on some trip. I started to feel, well, if I did a 25-minute weird thing with John Whiting that later I could go home and take the tape and cut it to shreds and cut it down to this 2-minute, absolutely magnificent, totally weird conversation, you know. And often that proved to be true, actually.
Yeah. Our art is selectivity.
Yeah, right. Right.
In whatever manifestation.
Right. During all this period, Watts and I became quite close friends, and at one point, a guy came over from, I think it was South India. He was the head of All India Radio or some big shot in All India Radio. And Lou Hill called me up and said, Sandy, this guy, I think his name was Menon, I can't remember. So this guy is coming from South India, and would you kind of show him around and hang out with him? And I said, sure. And I got to know this Indian broadcast executive, and then he kind of opened up to me, and he said, well, you know, I'm really very fond of making music. I play the veena. And said, if you'd like, if you set it up for me, I'll give a little concert, you know, if you can find the right place. Mm-hmm. So I called Alan Watts at that time, was dean of a school in the city called the American Academy of Asian Studies.
Yes, remember that.
I called Alan. I said, there's this veena player who wants to do a concert. Could we do it at the Academy? Oh, yeah, no problem. Fine, we'll do it. Sounds great. So this was really just a few months before the first Vortex performance. And I went to the Academy with the veena guy, and this woman was there, this incredibly beautiful woman. She looked, I thought she was Italian. She was dressed very, very slick and everything. And I asked the person I was in, I said, no, that is, oh, yeah, that's Sabra Hasegawa's daughter. And then I remembered Sabra Hasegawa was a kind of a Zen master, calligrapher, painter, tea ceremony guy that Watts had brought over from Japan. And this is his Eurasian daughter, not half Japanese, half Dutch. I said, oh, my God, I've never seen anything like that. Whoa, God. And a
About 2 weeks later, a friend of mine that I had actually gone to the concert with, a wife of a close friend, the friend was away at the time and she had gone with me, she called me and she said, "Oh, Sandy, I'm having an Easter party and I wonder if you'd do me a favor." And I said, "Well, sure, what do you need?" She said, "Would you mind driving Sumire Hasegawa to the party? You'll have to pick her up in the city and da-da." "No," I said, I don't think I'd mind that at all."
Mm-hmm. "Yeah, well, you pay me."
Yeah. And 2 months later, Sumire and I were married. And I innocently thought, you know, well, I'd had these close friends, one of whom you may know. Do you know Garfias, Bob Garfias?
No.
He used to be a lot on KPFA. He's quite a famous ethnomusicologist. Mm-hmm. And he and Vince Delgado, the percussionist, were both married to Japanese women. And they were really close friends of mine, my first good friends that I'd met when I moved to San Francisco. And it was like, well, if you live in San Francisco, the only thing to do is find a Japanese wife because that's where it's at, period. There is no other way to exist. So I meet this gorgeous woman, and I thought, you know, well, I was kind of in control and doing this thing. The next thing I know, I used to humorously refer to myself as a prisoner of war, because you know, my whole diet changed, everything about it, my way of being, everything changed to fit into this thing. And then pretty soon there were children.
In the words of George Bernard Shaw, "You are the pursued, the marked down quarry, the chosen prey."
And I lived with this woman for 17 years, got absolutely, totally spoiled rotten. And everything else, Vortex, the comedy stuff, it all sort of settled in somewhere in the background. And then I made this absurd.
Were you forced to earn a living in any form during this time?
Stuff would just happen, you know. I mean, all the fallout from this Vortex stuff and the Time magazine stuff, everybody thought I was some kind of famous genius. And if there was money involved, I'd let them believe it, you know, because I had lots of good things to spend the money on. And
there's an art to being a professional celebrity.
Right. And then my ex-wife was an absolutely unbelievable cook and hostess. So, you know, the Bank of America, the architects for the Bank of America would get me involved in this thing, and then we'd have a dinner party and have some of them come for dinner. And we had the first hot bath in California, and we had this beautiful place in Mill Valley. And then she would just blow people away with her cooking and stuff. And I mean, I'm not talking about Japanese cooking. Mm-hmm. She learned Korean cooking, Chinese cooking, Indian cooking, French cooking, North African cooking, and I would, every week I would bring home a new cooking book to turn her on to some new thing that she didn't know about, and she loved it. She'd, "Oh yeah, tonight we're going to have whatever, you know. Uruguayan pork chops, right?"
Yeah, the night of the iguana, right. Gustatorily.
So then, by that time, I was, by the mid-60s, I was no longer enamored of of electronic or musique concrète, electronic music. And Ali Akbar Khan had been brought over to the Bay Area by the Scripps family.
The Scripps family,
yeah. Sam Scripps, and his Sam Scripps' wife was very much involved with learning the Indian North Indian dance, Bharatanatyam. Can't remember the name. They had brought Ali Akbar Khan over to teach a year of classical Indian string music, and I didn't have any money problems at the time, and I decided to enroll and try to. Stupidly, I didn't elect to study the sarod, which is Ali Akbar Khan's instrument, and the sarod is like this. That's what you're doing. I had a few encounters with Ravi Shankar prior to that. He'd come to my studio and recorded, and I said, "Oh, I want to learn sitar." You know. So instead of learning to do this from a teacher that does this, I'm learning to do this from a teacher that does this. Not happening. Very stupid decision. You know, really stupid. It's like studying saxophone with Miles Davis or something. You know, I mean, what?
Yeah.
Miles plays trumpet. It isn't a saxophone. Yeah. It's just three keys. It's not 72.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, I've worked with both Ali Akbar Khan and
Miles.
Shankar.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of amplification, sound projection for Indian musicians in London, and it was my exposure over several years to Indian music was through working with them.
Right. And, well, I tried for 5 years to. You know, by this time I was in, I think, early 40s, and I just finally had to face it. Hey, if you want to do this and do it really fast, you know, do that. You got to start when you're 8 years old or 11 at least. You know, you can't start at 40.
Yeah. I'm 35 and I'd like to be a ballet dancer.
Yeah, right. You know, so. I tried that for 5 years, couldn't cut it. But at the end of 5 years, I'd gotten totally comfortable with this kind of, you know, this kind of stuff. Sitting like this for 5 hours. So my body was, and I, being married to a Japanese, I was used to sitting on the floor for, you know, I decided chairs were actually some really decadent Western thing that didn't relate to the human body and were just, you know, more Western madness. And what year was it? 1970, I guess. I officially gave up the sitar, figured I can't cut this. And I had to do something, I didn't know what it was. And I ran into George Leonard, the writer. Ran into his wife, his ex-wife. She said, "Oh, Sandy, George and I are into this interesting thing. It's happening in the city, and it's a special Esalen thing. But you can come and be our guest. Come check it out. It's a thing called Aikido, and there's this master that teaches, and it's really interesting." So I went in and took an Aikido class, and it felt good. And that was, I don't know, 25 years ago or so. I'm still doing it. I did it yesterday.
Right. Well, as I say, whatever turns you on.
Yeah. And then from my childhood, musically, suddenly a neighbor right near us on the hill here gave me a tape to listen to. And it was a recording made of a man named Art Tatum, who had been hired in Hollywood to be a consultant on the making of Young Man with a Horn or one of those. And apparently at the conclusion of the making of the film, they had invited him to their Beverly Hills home and said, come on, Art, play some of the old tunes. And so here are all these Hollywood types sitting around a piano, and Art Tatum is there playing Love for Sale and Embraceable You and all this. And I suddenly remember from my, you know, when I was 15 years old, going into Chicago to hear jazz for the first time and meeting decadent old men who would say, hey, man, come up to my pad. We'll smoke a joint. I want to play you some Art Tatum, man. You haven't heard Art Tatum. You don't know what music is. You know, come dig Art Tatum. And I heard Tatum again. And Art Tatum, I cannot believe that I live in a society that's made a movie about the life of Dexter Gordon, and they've overlooked Art Tatum? Mm-hmm. I mean, give me a break.
Yeah. The trouble is, as soon as you start doing something, you know, rather well, for no money, and then somebody with money hears it and says, hey, that's pretty good. Come along, do it for me, I'll pay you. And then you immediately have an overlay of their taste on top of it. So, no, why don't you do it that way? Yeah. And that, you know, give it a little more pizzazz. Yeah. And you're suddenly into a different world.
Well, but
you're into Van Gogh painted with luminous paints. Yeah.
Well, I have discovered just in the last year that life really is worth living and there is a future. I have discovered a Cuban 30-year-old piano player who I, with absolute certainty, can say he is the Bach of the 20th century. This man is so fucking talented that it's, and because he's Cuban, he's been obscured from the view of the American public. He's known internationally. Mm-hmm. Gonzalo Rubalcaba. Hmm. Don't forget that name. Gonzalo Rubalcaba.
Well, I can't forget it because it's there.
Right.
Is he, what sort of genre does he fall into?
All genre. He sounds like Thelonious Monk, Debussy, Shostakovich, Stravinsky, Bartok, Stockhausen, Art Tatum, all at once.
Does he play in jazz venues or in other?
He's made a lot. He's made a number of recordings with people like Charlie Hayden and Jack DeJohnette, who are very big jazz musicians. He's Rubalcaba is another story. I mean, all I can say is if you have the opportunity,
just putting in a start ID there, which will help me find the.
And I heard him I was up in Canada with my girlfriend in a campground, and we turned on public radio one morning at 7 in the morning, and there was an interview with Rubalcaba and a translator, because he doesn't speak English. And I'll give you a taste before you go. Having talked about him so much, I'll try to give you a taste, yeah.
Well, have we
talked about Alan Watts?
Yeah.
Right. Well, Alan, of course, when Alan discovered that I was getting seriously involved with Sumire Hasegawa, and since Alan was the one who had brought Sumire's father to this country, and because Sumire's father had died just a few months before I had met her, Alan felt concerned about, you know, well, I was kind of the instrument of these people meeting, and is Henry going to be okay for Sumi, and is Sumi going to be okay for Henry, and da-da-da-da-da. And then about that time, I saw Black Orpheus and became aware of the fact that there was this new machine that had been designed by this mad Pole named Kudelski, and I bought one of them for myself. Wow. And I suddenly realized I had this whole bevy of Ampexes, and they were all obsolete, right? Just trash. Total trash compared to the Nagra, you know. And I'm thinking, God, why do I need all these big machines? I can just get this little thing in a leather case.
And even smaller, the Stellavox, which was of comparable quality.
I never had one, but I remember that.
I've still got one.
You've got a Stellavox.
I did my serious work with a Stellavox for 20 years until digital came along.
Did Kudelski have anything to do with that, or was that a totally separate thing?
I think he did have something to do with it in the very earliest stages, although it's a separate company.
Uh-huh. Right. So when I discovered the existence of the Nagra, I got together with Alan and I said, look, you know, you're doing all this lecturing and seminar giving and stuff, and people are recording you and tapes are going here and there. I said, we ought to really set it up so that you record everything and we'll just archive it. And we can review it from time to time. If there's stuff you don't like, we'll erase it. And he said, yeah, that's a good idea. So we got a little money together and got a Nagra for Alan. And then we had many conferences and decided, well, now look, if you have to say there's a Chevy parked out in front, don't turn the machine on until you got rid of that, doing that business. And then started out by saying what it is you're going to talk about. And then go ahead and talk for... We decided we're going to use 1 mil tape, so 7-inch reel, 90 or whatever it is, 45 minutes, right? I said, figure that's going to be the length of what you're going to do, and then if you want,
did you use it open so it would take 7-inch reels?
Yeah. It was open, 3 3/4.
Three and three quarters. It wouldn't have had to be open 1 mil.
Wait a minute. What were we?
Because closed, it would take 5-inch reels, but open, it would take 7-inch reels.
Now, he did 7-inch reels, and most of the masters are at 3 3/4.
Oh.
So that would have gone 90 minutes, actually, right?
Yes, it would.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But he did want it to be 45 minutes, then he would take an intermission, then he would reconvene with the group, and he wouldn't turn the recorder on because he felt that the question answers might get personal or people
were you recording mono or stereo at this point?
Mono. This was a Nagra 3.
Uh-huh. And was it half track or a full track machine?
Full track.
It was full track. So it wasn't a question of turning the tape over and doing anything in the other direction. Right.
Okay. No. And then he got onto the idea that at the end of the talk he should sort of culminate with some sort of boffo, wowie, you know, thing to leave them with. Mm-hmm. And he got, you know, we talked about that at great length. He used to love to sit around and talk about the difference between written word and spoken word. And how. Mm-hmm. And I'd never met anybody who really got into that. I mean, it's pretty esoteric to deal with language at that level. Yeah. And Alan was completely into that, you know.
He was an artist in front of a microphone, and it showed.
Right. And he could get completely plastered at 5 o'clock in the evening, and I'd drive him to some lecture, and he'd be sleeping in the car, and I'd have to wake him up and practically drag him in. And he'd go backstage, you know, and sort of go, walk out. Tonight, I'm going to talk on landscape, soundscape, and architecture in the late 20th century. And do it. And I know he'd be plastered or...
So you have a lot of these tapes, an enormous number of them.
Yeah, right.
And I gather that you are both a repository and a distribution point.
Right. I produce these programs which are in Los Angeles and a few smaller stations here and there, and people hear them and call up and want to get the tapes. And I around 1973, when my Japanese wife and I split up, I just completely pulled back as far as going out and hustling communication consultant gigs. And now I become a recluse. Here I am.
Well, I can't think of a better place to be a recluse.
Yeah.
What about the programs on KPFA that Alan did? Did you have anything to do with those?
No, not really.
Did you get him there? Did you bring him there?
Did I get him there?
Did you bring, yes.
No, no. He was. That was already happening when I moved to the Bay Area. He was on KPFA. And we met at some KPFA event. You know.
Do you know how he first associated himself with KPFA?
Elsa Gidlow might have been the connect there. I don't know.
Is that a name you couldn't remember before?
Elsa Gidlow was the lesbian poetess.
Yeah, you couldn't remember her name. I tried to remember, but it was Elsa, wasn't it?
Yeah, I have a feeling it was, yeah. Might have been.
The one that you say was on the cover of the record?
No, no,
that's
another.
That's
Peggy Tolk Watkins is the woman on the cover.
There we go.
T-O-L-K hyphen Watkins. And her girlfriend, whose name I don't remember.
All right.
Yes. Rex Roth did a very nice program when she died on her.
On Elsa?
Elsa, yes.
Yeah, I didn't like Elsa very much, to tell you the truth. Well, she lived out at what they call Druid Heights, which belongs to a friend of mine, Roger Summers, who Alan dedicated his LSD book to, The Joyous Cosmology, was dedicated to Roger.
Do you know how Alan first got associated with KPFA? Who brought him on?
Well, I was guessing that it was Elsa.
It was.
I don't know, you know. My first contact with Alan Watts was first one of my high school buddies had gone into the Navy in World War II at Northwestern University and was trying to get a medical discharge or something or get some kind of special treatment and went to talk to the chaplain, who turned out to be this young, super hip, great person named Alan Watts. And the next chapter of that was I was living in...
Of course, that was pre-Buddhist, back when he was an Anglican...
Yeah, but he wrote his first articles on Zen when he was 16. He wrote a scholarly article on Zen at the age of 16.
But he was an Anglican clergyman.
He was an Anglican priest, true. Right. That's correct. And what was the subject we were just dealing with before that? Because I thought of a connect there.
Oh, we're talking about the connection with KPFA.
Wondering how Alan first got associated with KPFA.
Oh, I know. I was just going to say my second encounter with Alan was after college. I lived in New Orleans for a while, and there was this advertising guy named Tom Newman. Tom Newman was responsible for setting up the exotic colony in Jalapa outside of Puerto Vallarta. Yeah. They went down and had some sort of marijuana cult going there in those days. God. But Tom was this super dapper New Orleans ad man who, during the week, he would wear these very expensive clothes and he would be flying back and forth to L.A. to record Nat King Cole for commercials and stuff. And then on the weekends, he would put his blue jeans on and hang around the French Quarter of New Orleans, which is like North Beach or something. And he would always have a book, carrying a book, and it would be an Alan Watts book. You know, it was kind of like wearing a badge, right?
His credentials.
Right, his credential was carrying an Alan Watts book. So by the time I came to the West Coast and discovered I was in this same milieu and same environment with Alan Watts, I had this prepping of, hey, there's this really incredible person, you know. And He was, definitely. He's mm-hmm. no doubt about that, right, Eric?
About that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But he was already on KPFA when you got
here. He was on KPFA, yes. He was doing, KPFA had given him some WebCore type machine, and he was in his bedroom at night. He would do a little half-hour talk. And those talks are all much more somber than the ones he did with audiences later with his seminars and whatnot.
Yes, he alternated with Kenneth Rexroth on Sunday morning,
right,
as I recall.
Right.
Yeah. I was just saying to Eric earlier, and somebody else earlier still, that to me the wonderful thing about KPFA in its very early days, the most distinctive and marvelous thing about it was that it allowed you to eavesdrop on some of the incredibly stimulating conversations that were going on around Berkeley at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was an exposure to people's minds.
Mm-hmm.
People that you would not meet mm-hmm. or have a chance to, circles that you would not be invited into because you were not part of the inner circle.
Yeah.
And suddenly there they were, your dinner guests.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And considering the rest of radio in America, you know, it's a pretty bleak
mm-hmm.
landscape.
Oh, yeah, and since. And the trouble, and today at KPFA, the people that are giving the dinner parties aren't inviting the right guests anymore.
I guess. Well, Isata Iman did not go to the university, right? Or did she?
She passed it by.
She's the one that 86'd Watts. Do you know who she is?
No, I don't.
She's a third world black lady who got hired at KPFA.
Oh, she, right, yes. Now
she
I'm,
does a thing at
yeah,
noon
right,
called Viewpoints or Horizons or what is it called?